From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Shirley Horn was one of Miles Davis's favorite singers. She's become a favorite of many jazz fans. On today's Fresh Air, a concert and conversation with singer and pianist Shirley Horn. Also, Nick Toshis wrote a biography of rocker Jerry Lee Lewis. So why is his new biography about Dean Martin, the kind of Vegas celebrity that rock and roll stood against? We'll ask Nick Toshis. And rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about the song he can't get out of his head. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court today upheld most provisions of a restrictive Pennsylvania abortion law, but stopped short of overturning the Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in the United States. The court upheld a portion of the Pennsylvania law that would require unmarried minors to get parental consent for an abortion. It would also require women to be briefed on options to abortion and to wait 24 hours before having the procedure. The vote on the issue was 5-4, with Reagan-Bush appointees Anthony Kennedy, Sandra Day O'Connor, and David Souter joining the majority. Following today's Supreme Court ruling on abortion, Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton delivered a strongly worded defense of abortion rights. Ben Fry of member station KUAR reports.
Speaking at the University of Arkansas Law Library, presidential hopeful Bill Clinton criticized the high court's decision in the Pennsylvania case. The Arkansas governor said it was abundantly clear that the Constitution's right to privacy was in danger. Governor Clinton said the court was only one justice away from overturning the landmark Roe v. Wade decision, which made abortion legal.
It may be a court for Bush and for Reagan, but it's our country and our constitutional rights. And I think this election now plainly imposes on all American citizens the obligation to protect our liberties.
Clinton said if he were president, he would not appoint a justice who didn't support the constitutional right to privacy. Clinton said this case will make abortion rights an important issue in the general election. For National Public Radio, I'm Ben Fry in Little Rock.
The United Nations Security Council unanimously agreed today to send 1,000 peacekeeping troops to secure the airport in the besieged Bosnian city of Sarajevo. The troops will help conduct an airlift of food and relief supplies. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The council agreed to send a battalion of Canadian peacekeepers now stationed in Croatia to assist in the airdrop. French air traffic controllers will coordinate the effort. The operation is expected to get underway as early as tomorrow. The decision to deploy the troops came after UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali issued a report saying conditions in Sarajevo had stabilized and Serb forces had agreed to pull away from the airport. Only last Friday, Boutros-Ghali was warning that the UN might have to end its relief plan in Sarajevo because of continued fighting there. With its resolution today, the Council did not authorize military action against the warring parties, but it did warn that force may be considered if either side attempts to interfere with the airdrop. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Stock prices were up sharply today on Wall Street. Analysts said that investors were encouraged by hopes for a cut in interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 37 points to close at 3,319.86. Advances led declines by almost 2-1 in active trading. This is NPR News. Authorities in Algeria now say that the assassin of President Mohamed Moudiaf was captured rather than killed by the president's bodyguard, as had been previously reported. The 73-year-old head of state was gunned down today as he made a speech in the eastern part of the country. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the attack, but the country has been shaken by a conflict between the military-backed government and an outlawed Islamic fundamentalist party. A government statement said that 41 people were injured today when the gunman opened fire on Boudiaf with a submachine gun. A car that runs primarily on alcohol was unveiled today at an alternative fuels conference in Milwaukee. From member station WUWM, Bob Bach has details.
America's first ethanol fuel car was presented to Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson by General Motors today. The Chevy Lumina test car runs on 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline. It is the first of 50 such cars that will become part of state vehicle fleets in Wisconsin and Illinois next year. GM Vice President Gerald Barnes says the company hopes to produce the cars for public sale within the next 12 months. Ethanol fuel is made primarily from corn. Its use as a renewable automotive fuel is considered a plus for the environment and a boost to farm state economies. Chief executives from 17 states are in Milwaukee for the Governor's Ethanol Coalition and National Alternative Fuels Conference. For National Public Radio, this is Bob Bach in Milwaukee.
Officials in California say that strong aftershocks are hampering their efforts to clean up after yesterday's powerful earthquakes. There were at least four strong aftershocks today, ranging from 4.9 to 5.4 on the Richter scale. More than 1,100 homes and 33 businesses were damaged by yesterday's quakes, and today some of those weakened buildings were tumbled by the aftershocks. Many people in the Yucca Valley spent the night in tents and cars rather than risk the collapse of their homes. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Shirley Horn, is the opposite of a belter. She has a small voice and an intimate style. There are performances in which every note, every pause, every breath seem perfect. We invited her to record a concert and conversation a few days ago when she was in Philadelphia to perform at the Mellon PSFS Jazz Festival. Horn made her first record back in 1962. One of her first champions was Miles Davis. But in the late 60s, the 70s, and early 80s, Horn rarely performed outside Washington, D.C., where she's always lived. She stayed close to home to bring up her daughter. In 1988, she started recording for Verve Records, and that led to a comeback that has brought her international attention. Her new album is Shirley Horn with Strings. Performing with her today are the longtime members of her trio, bassist Charles Abels and drummer Steve Williams. Shirley Horn is, of course, at the piano. Here we go.
Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy for us to fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax and please don't worry. We're gonna fall in love. We're on the road to romance. That's safe to say. But let's make all the stops along the way. The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses, to rush would be a crime, 'cause nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it every time. Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy. Us to fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax and please don't worry.
we're gonna fall in love. We're on the road to romance, that's safe to say. But let's make all the stops along the way. The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses. To rush would be a crime, 'cause nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it.
Lucky or what? That sounds great.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you for being here. Shirley Horn singing, and at the piano, Charles Abels on bass, Steve Williams drums. Shirley Horn, I'm listening to you singing and playing piano and thinking, she almost became a classical pianist. Because you were a prodigy. You had a scholarship to Juilliard when you were young, which I think you never actually took.
No, my parents couldn't afford to. They couldn't afford it.
The scholarship didn't pay your living expenses, so you didn't have
it.
Yeah. Now, is that why you didn't become a classical pianist?
I don't know. I really don't know. I didn't know if I would have gone into jazz anyway. But then Earl Garner came along and he influenced me.
Did he come along in person or on record?
No, on record. He had a hit record. It was called Penthouse Serenade. And I remembered that. I used to sit with the record player next to me on the piano, and it plays record over and over and over, and just copy him note for note. He used to drive my mother crazy, but he was like the beginning, you know.
Do you still play classical music? Do you keep up with it?
No, I'm ashamed. No, no. About 10 years ago, I threatened, you know, so I wanted to do a classical album. But it's laziness. That's pure and simple. It's just lazy.
Well, you've got your hands full, I mean.
Right now, yeah.
Yeah. Did you sing before you started singing professionally? Because I know you started out as a pianist. You didn't start singing as a performer till, well, a little bit later. I don't know exactly when.
Well, I sang in Sunday school and church, and but I was sneaking a job at a dinner theater in Washington, and there was an old gentleman who would come in every night, tip his hat, have dinner, and leave, right? And it was getting close to Christmas, and he came in with this teddy bear as tall as I. And for some reason, I just felt like, that's my teddy bear. It was beautiful, great big turquoise teddy bear. And he sent a note to me and said, if you sing Melancholy Baby, the teddy bear is yours. And I sang Melancholy Baby. You know, I knew all kind of songs and things. My mother is very musical. My family is very musical, and I heard the best music at home, you know.
So that was the first time you sang?
That was the first time.
Outside of church, in public?
Yeah, I'm scared to death. But there was a woman there whose name was Clara Bow, an older woman who played and sang. She was terrific. And she sort of looked out for me. And she went to the owner and said, well, she can sing, so she's got to get more money. So I went from $75 a week to $175 a week.
Wow.
That was a lot of money then.
Well, that's a big jump, too.
Yeah. So I said, well, okay, I'll sing. You know, I never studied, you know. I just, I guess maybe listened to my mom, and that was it.
This would be a good time to hear you sing some more. Can I ask you to do another song?
Sure.
Great.
It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around and finally found the somebody who make me be true. Could make me feel blue. And even be glad. Just to be sad, thinking of you. Some others I've seen, might never be me, might never be cross or try to be boss, but they didn't do. Nobody else gave me a thrill. With all your faults, I love you still. It had to be you. Wonderful you. It had to be you.
Oh, that's truly beautiful. We have Shirley Horn on vocals and at the piano, with Charles Abels on bass, Steve Williams on drums. Well, I almost feel like at a loss for words. It's just so wonderful to have you here. What I think we'll do is take a short break and then be back and talk some more and hear some more music with Shirley Horn. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a concert today with Shirley Horn. She's piano and vocals, Charles Abel's bass, Steve Williams drums. You know, you were telling us before how you started to play after that whole melancholy baby story where somebody came in and asked you to sing. I mean, how you started to sing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And did you have a I love your voice, and it's a very small voice, and I think some singers feel that to really sing, you've got to have like a big voice. Did you ever feel that way yourself? That did you ever try to push your voice to be bigger than it is, louder?
Well, I'll tell you like this. I can scream. it kind of depends on the song, and the songs that I like, that I lean toward, are need a soft approach. There's some boisterous. I've done some singing. You would be surprised. You know, I don't prefer it.
Do you think of yourself as being shy as a performer?
Yeah.
And how does that affect you when you're performing?
I think I'm myself, you know, when I'm performing. I'm not a, you know, I've had the pleasure to go to listen to singers, performers, and they get on the microphone and it's all this blah, 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 talk and everything. You know, I came to hear you sing, you know, whatever you're going to do, do it, right? I don't think all that's necessary. I'm kind of a laid-back person. I've always been a little shy. Right, guys?
I take it you're not shy with the band.
Oh, we're family. You know what happens with family.
Shirley Horn, one of your first real champions was Miles Davis. And he, one of the last records that he made before he died was sitting in on one of your recent albums. He got in touch with you after your first record and asked you to sit in with him or to open for him at the Village Vanguard in New York.
No, he asked. I was in Virginia with my husband at my mother-in-law's table, eating all kind of good food and everything. And the phone rang, and I said, Miss Ollie, this is for you. I went to the phone and, Shirley, I want you to come to New York. Some people I think you should meet. And I said to myself, I said, who is this? It's Miles Davis. And I thought it was a friend of mine, somebody making a joke with me. And so I went back to the table because, you know, it was all kind of fried chicken and red-eyed gravy and buttermilk biscuits and, oh, boy. And I started thinking. I said, Shep, it's my husband. I said, I think I better go to New York. And I did. I called a friend of the family, met me, and we went to his house to let me know that he was serious. He had some young kids then, and they were singing, I mean, 4, 5, 6 like that. They were singing songs for my first record. So, yes, and I did meet some very important people with him.
Did he tell you what he responded to about your music?
He liked my use of space and my chords and the way my voice sings and the way I played and sang, you know. Well, the use of space, you know.
It's an interesting thing for him to respond to, since he also used space.
Yes.
In his playing. Yeah. So, did you remain close over the years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We didn't see a lot of each other because he was very busy, you know, but toward the end, just last year, we were doing the same concert here at the Academy of Music, and we had time here, we had time in France.
Yeah, where you shared the bill with him last year.
Yeah. We were very close, spiritually. He was a great man. I miss him a lot. He's part of me is gone with him, you know.
Yeah. I got to get back to your childhood when you were playing classical music.
Mm-hmm.
What introduced you to classical music?
My grandmother told my mother to give me piano lessons because I couldn't stay away from that piano. You go to my grandmother's house, she had a parlor. You know, that's where company went, and it was always cold in there. And she had an old upright piano. And I wouldn't go out and play with the other kids. I would just go and sit on it. And I remember putting on a coat always, and she had a stool, you know, wound up and down. And my grandmother said, told my mother, give me lessons. And so I had lessons when I was 4. I couldn't read or write. Other kids would cry and what have you when they went to take the lessons, and I always look forward to it.
You mentioned it was cold in the parlor where your grandmother had the piano.
That's where company went, you know. But and always closed. Those French doors were always closed. But I would go in there, and they wouldn't bother me, and I'd stay in there always with a coat on. Right? And I'd pick at this piano, you know.
If you don't mind my mentioning this, in between songs, you've been putting on gloves.
Yeah, my hands stay a little cold. I have a bit of a problem. Sometimes I play in gloves. In fact, I'll be playing in gloves at night.
Really?
Yeah.
Will you wear those, like, white sheer gloves to play in?
Yeah, these. Same ones.
Yeah, right. So it keeps the circulation better in your fingers?
Mm-hmm.
Is your touch okay? When you're wearing the gloves?
Yeah.
So flexible, you could pick up a dime, right? Remember
those
commercials?
Really. Yeah.
Those are for rubber gloves, yeah. Well, we have time for one more song.
Okay. What is it?
Fooling Myself is what you're going to do.
Okay. I tell myself I'm through with you, and I'll have nothing more to do with you. I ran away, but every day I'm just fooling myself. I tell my friends that I don't care. I shrug my shoulders at the whole affair. But they all know it isn't so. I'm just fooling myself. Every time I pass and see my face in the looking glass, I tip my hat and say, how do, you fool? You're throwing your life away. I'm acting gay, I'm acting proud. And every time I see you in a crowd, I ran away. But every day, I'm just fooling myself. Looking glass, I tip my hat and say, how do, you fool? You're throwing your life away. I'm acting gay, I'm acting proud. And every time I see you in a crowd, I may pretend this is the end. I'm just fooling.
We've made today a very special day for us. I want to thank you so much for performing on Fresh Air. It's really been very special. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great. And my guest has been Shirley Horn, who has been singing and also at the piano with Charles Abels on bass, Steve Williams on drums. And you can hear their latest records on Verve. And the very latest Shirley Horn record is called Here's to Life, and it features Shirley Horn with strings and orchestral arrangements by Johnny Mandel. There are several albums with the trio on Verve Records, so if you want to hear more, that's the place to go. Thank you again so much.
Thank you.
I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air, and can I ask you to play us out?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dean Martin made it to number one on the pop chart. He had a hit TV show and hit movies. His public image was the celebrity who loved booze and chicks and ran with the Rat Pack. Nick Toshis isn't a fan of most of Martin's work, yet there's something that fascinates him about the nature of Martin's fame. Coming up, we talk with Toshis about his new biography, Dino, Living High in the Dirty Business of Dreams. And rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about the song he can't get out of his head and the song he'd like to keep there instead. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. By a vote of 5-4, the U.S. Supreme Court has given states new powers to make it harder for women to have abortions, but at the same time did not make abortions illegal. By one vote, the High Court fell short of overturning its Roe v. Wade ruling that legalized abortions. The court's main opinion was co-authored by Justices O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter. While upholding most abortion restrictions in a Pennsylvania law, the High Court struck down by a 5-4 vote a provision that required married women in most cases to tell their husbands about their plans for an abortion. Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey says that he's satisfied with the overall ruling issued by the High Court today. Ed Ark of member station WITF in Harrisburg reports.
Speaking in Harrisburg, Governor Casey said he was pleased with the ruling handed down today. He called the decision a victory for unborn children.
The decision moves the country sharply away from abortion on demand and begins to reestablish in our law, in a balanced and reasonable way, the historic and traditional rights of members of the family, mothers, their unborn children, parents.
Although disagreeing with the court's decision to strike down a provision calling for spousal notification prior to an abortion, Casey said the court not only upheld the law, but reflected the views of most Americans in its overall decision. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Ark in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Also today, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that property owners may be entitled to compensation whenever government regulations prohibit them from developing their property. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a 6-3 decision, the High Court sided with South Carolina developer David Lucas, who in 1986 spent $1 million for two oceanfront lots for development, and then was told by the South Carolina Coastal Council that development would contribute to beach erosion and was therefore prohibited. Lucas argued that the state's environmental regulations had rendered his property worthless and sought more than $1 million in compensation. Justice Antonin Scalia, in his written opinion for the majority, said the state of South Carolina cannot simply declare that Lucas's development plans are inconsistent with the public interest. The case now returns to the lower court to determine whether Lucas must be paid compensation. Today's decision could have a far-reaching impact on the power of the states to impose environmental regulations on private property. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Officials of McDonnell Douglas say the company has a $1 billion contract to build 40 airplanes for China. The first airplanes are due for delivery in 1996. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 37 points to close at 3,319. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, Serbian forces have pulled out of the airport at Sarajevo, and a small group of UN peacekeepers has moved in. In New York, the UN Security Council has approved sending a peacekeeping force of 1,000 to help secure the airport in order for planes carrying food and medicine to land. The airport has been under siege for 3 months, and 300,000 people living in the capital are facing starvation. UN officials have said if the peacekeeping force is attacked, then international military action could follow. Southern California remains on alert for more aftershocks following the largest earthquake there in more than 40 years. But earthquake scientists cannot tell whether the quakes raise or lower the risk of a devastating earthquake on the San Andreas Fault, which runs through heavily populated parts of the state. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The first quake on Sunday morning struck on a fault that has been pretty much dormant for 10,000 years, so scientists weren't expecting a big quake there. But once it happened, state officials immediately warned that more large earthquakes could be coming. Sure enough, a few hours later, a second quake occurred 30 miles away in the San Andreas fault zone. The big question now is what those earthquakes mean for the future. One theory holds that the quakes have relieved some of the stress building up underground in Southern California, so the big one could be less likely. But it's also possible that the first quake actually increased the risk of a huge earthquake by shifting more stress to the San Andreas Fault. Scientists say it's impossible to say which theory is right. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
State officials in California have set up a telephone hotline to handle a flood of damage claims they are expecting from earthquake victims. Homeowners are eligible for up to $14,000 in state funds to help pay for damage caused by a quake. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
The sound of Dean Martin's voice on the radio was always my cue to turn to another station. I didn't like the Martin and Lewis movies any better. As for Dean Martin's TV show, what a womanizer. So why, when a new biography of Dean Martin came to my attention, did I immediately think, oh boy, I'd like to do something on that? Well, a few reasons. I've actually seen a couple of movies on video lately, like Rio Bravo and Some Came Running, in which Dean Martin was really good. In the past few years, I've learned Dino was a big influence on Elvis. And the author of the new biography, Dino, Nick Toshis, wrote an earlier biography of Jerry Lee Lewis. And I wanted to find out why someone captivated by a wild rocker would choose to write about a slick celeb like Martin.
Oddly enough, the only living person that intrigued me was Dean Martin, because there seemed to be in him, there seemed to reside a mystery far more profound than anyone else I could think of, including Elvis, who idolized him. He made Elvis look like a publicity hound. He made Elvis look like Jesse Jackson. It was just amazing. And I tried to plumb that mystery, and I went back to the source, and oddly enough, I went and I got his birth certificate, and it was blank. He had no name. And that was sort of indicative of what was to follow for the next 2 years.
What was the mystery to you that Dean Martin embodied?
It was basically, who was this guy that cast such a high profile and was so famous and celebrated, and everyone had a very distinct impression of his persona, and yet no one knew him. I did not meet anyone who understood him. His wife, who was married to him, his second wife was married to him for more than 20 years, said that he was a stranger when she married him, and 20-odd years later was still a stranger. She knew nothing else about him.
Why did you care? Was there anything about his talents as an actor or a singer that made you care?
What made me care was he embodied an attitude. He was a guy who prevailed. He's the only person who ever achieved the highest position in movies, in recording, on stage and on television. Now, no one else could do that. Frank Sinatra never made it on television. And yet, he seemed to deride his own success, not take it seriously. He seemed to have no respect for acting, no respect for films. To him, recording was a lark. His idea of performing was to get on and off as quickly as possible and collect the check. He would not rehearse for television, and yet had the biggest show of a generation. And there was something about that, a person that if you look at the top of the heap of American popular culture as just junk, he seems to be the only person that ever scaled to the top of that heap who recognized it as such.
Did you think of his work as junk?
I think of the majority of his work as junk, just as I think of the majority of basically every American popular hero's work as junk. Of course, there are many exceptions. I think if you listen to Dean's early 50s recording of Return to Sorrento, if you see him act in The Young Lions or Some Came Running, there are glimpses of brilliance there that cannot be denied.
Yeah, it was a real surprise to me when I saw Some Came Running, which was just a few years ago, and saw Rio Bravo, you know, in the 80s, and realized, wow, there's real talent here.
The Young Lions.
Yeah. So in doing this biography, Dean Martin wouldn't talk with you.
No, I made every entree I could, and those closest to him told me that, A, I would learn absolutely nothing from Dean, that he's completely disconnected from his own life and past, and was not a good source for his own history. I would have liked to have met him just for that experience. And the closest I came one weekend as I was finishing the book was a personal message from Dean, which was, quote, "Tell this guy I won't interview him if he won't interview me." And that was it.
He's a reckless now. Was he reckless when you started the book?
Yes, he had, his interest in life, I'd say, began to flag some time ago. And with the death of his son, I think whatever little interest was left was drained from him.
You call Dean Martin the missing link between Bing Crosby and Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
But where do you fit him in there?
Well, like Sinatra and most of the other so-called crooners, Dean was influenced by Crosby. And in turn, Elvis's main influence was directly Dean Martin. And oddly enough, if you take one of Elvis's early son singles, one side is a song that Dean had recorded called I Don't Care If the Sun Don't Shine. And take another early recording for Son by Elvis. It's Good Rockin' Tonight, which had originally been written and recorded by a black singer named Roy Brown, whose own idol and favorite singer was also Bing Crosby. So there is a link there. I think it went from Bing to some new chrome-plated sense of 50s cool to Elvis, taking it one step further.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nick Tashas, the author of the new book, Dino, Living High in the Dirty Business of Dreams. I'm going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Non dimenticare means don't forget you are my darling. Don't forget to be.
My guest is Nick Tashas. He wrote a biography several years ago of Jerry Lee Lewis. The subject of his new biography is Dean Martin. When you were writing your biography of Dean Martin, did you go back and watch the Martin and Lewis movies?
Yeah, I did. I did. I watched. Well, Dean starred in over 50 films, and I saw them all from the abysmal to the terrific. The Martin and Lewis movies were strange, and they just, it's difficult today to understand the vast success that they had. They still stand. Dime for dollar, some of the most profitable films ever made.
How did Martin and Lewis get together?
It was in New York. Dean was living with a bunch of people in a Times Square hotel and singing. He was a crooner. He was having some acclaim. Jerry had this strange act where he would play phonograph records and do pantomimes to them. It was called pantomimicry or something. And they played at a couple of the same joints, and at one place they started to fool around together on stage at the Havana Madrid. And the first time they were ever billed together was in Atlantic City at the 500 Club, and it became a huge overnight sensation. And it was just all the way up from there.
What was considered to be the magic of their act live?
Well, the way I see it, if you take 1947, 1948 as the beginning of so-called Cold War, America needed to be sorely distracted from the fear of that through some sort of cathartic insanity, which they did provide early tapes, early impressions of them on stage, it was just complete sheer lunacy. Plus, Dean's singing, which was good, and the essence of their act was something that had never been done, and that was of a romantic lead, a sexy guy, and a moronic monkey. It had never been done in comedy before as a stage act, and that was something new, and it just captured such a wide spectrum of attention from different groups, everything from old ladies to young kids. It just caught everybody.
Who initiated the split?
Dean did.
For what reason?
Over the years, it just built up where it seemed like it was the act consisted of Jerry Lewis getting all this immense praise for his so-called comic genius, and each film they made, Dean would be reduced more and more to his active part. It got to the point where he got to sing one song, and it was to a cage of circus animals in one picture. And even though he was a man with no great ambitions, I think he just got sick of this. And Jerry took more and more control of their films, and Jerry handed him a script one day for a movie that later became The Delicate Delinquent, Jerry's first solo movie, and Dean just said, forget it, and that was it. They played a few more dates together and finished the film, and then it was all over. And there was a lot of hatred there, enough hatred to carry them in a great chill for decades to come.
You didn't Dean Martin once say to Jerry Lewis, you're just a dollar sign to me?
Yeah. Jerry said that there was something special between them that they shouldn't relinquish, and Dean said, well, what's that? And Jerry said, I think it's love. And Dean said, you can talk about love all you want. I look at you and all I see is a dollar sign.
And Jerry Lewis told you this?
Yeah.
After Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis split up, Dean Martin started making movies on his own. And the first movie that he made in which he didn't sing at all was Some Came Running, which also starred Frank Sinatra and Shirley MacLaine. And I want to play a clip from this movie. I think we both agree that this is a really fine performance.
Yeah, I think he holds up the I think he's the best thing in the movie.
Mm-hmm. And in the movie, Frank Sinatra is a writer who's just returned to his small hometown, and he's just returned from the war. And
it's sort of the sequel to From Here to Eternity.
Yeah, and Dean Martin is a gambler. Mm-hmm. And here's a scene between Martin and Sinatra.
Hey, Dave, how would you like to make a pretty nice living without too much trouble?
Doing what?
Well, team up with me. I think we'd get along.
You mean gambling?
Sure, that's a nice profession. And you're pretty good at it.
No, I'm just lucky.
Well, name me one thing you ain't supposed to be lucky at in life. You take my old man. Now, he used to gamble when he was plowing up his fields, hoping for a crop. Sometimes he'd get one, sometimes he wouldn't. So I figure if a man's gonna gamble, he might as well do it without plowing.
Nah, I'm not gonna stick around here anyway. And besides, how can you get any real action in a dump like Parkman?
Oh, this is just my headquarters. I make all these big towns around here. It's a good idea, Dave. Then you'd have a lot of time to write. Why don't you think it over?
I just did.
You know, the kind of lack of caring that you were describing Dean Martin as having really works in this role. There's a detachment that really works for him.
He's terrific in a role like that. As I said, there are moments of brilliance that can't be denied, and I think his part in that picture is one of them. I think in that particular picture, he's the best thing. I think he was terrific also in The Young Lions. Well, he himself said at one point that clip you just played, that film, he just basically played himself.
Did he become something of an existentialist hero in France after this movie?
No, they were too infatuated with his ex-partner.
In the 1960s, Dean Martin had a TV show that was very high-rated for a while. And, I mean, his image on the show, he was the drunk womanizer. The show was all booze and chicks.
That's all it was. It was just, it was the lowest common denominator. It was, instead of lapses in taste. He had lapses in tastelessness. I mean, it just went on and on like that until it reached a complete nadir towards the end, when it devolved into the Dean Martin celebrity roast, which were a bunch of marginally alive human beings like Orson Welles sitting around, making believe they were sitting at the same table. One guy'd be in Los Angeles, the other guy'd be in Las Vegas, and they'd be laughing at these hollow jokes. And it was just, it was something very bizarre there.
As you point out, and I think this is another interesting thing about what that show represented, is that somehow Dean Martin managed to uphold and flaunt family values at the same time. I mean, since the show was all booze and chicks, but like the Christmas show, he'd be there with his wife and his many children singing Christmas carols under the tree.
Right, he worked both ends, the underlying impression being that beneath this rogue, there was a man who hewed to the traditional values of family and honor. And one of the things that hurt him was actually when he divorced his wife Jean of long standing to run off with the proverbial young blonde, that it shattered people's illusions.
About him?
Yeah.
And his ratings went down?
They just completely plummeted.
That was Nick Toshis. He's the author of Dino, Living High in the Dirty Business of Dreams. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, how will you be covering the Supreme Court decision on abortion?
Well, we'll be hearing from Nina Totenberg today about the decision which upheld some provisions of Pennsylvania's abortion law, but also threw out some others. Also, a report today from Brian Naylor about how this decision might affect some political races around the country this year. On other matters, we'll be talking to one of the surgeons who took part in the unprecedented transplant of a baboon's liver into a patient in Pittsburgh. And Noah Adams talks today with Shakespearean actor Ian McKellen about his career in the theater. McKellen is currently performing in an American production of Richard III.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's time to confront the most popular song of the summer so far, Billy Ray Cyrus's Achy Breaky Heart. Achy Breaky Heart is making its own kind of history this season. It's the first country hit to also top the pop charts in years. The song is featured on Cyrus's album, Some Gave All.
And joke about me on the phone. You can tell my arms go back into the barn. You can tell my feet to hit the floor. Or you can tell my lips to tell my fingertips they won't be reaching out for you no more. Don't tell my heart, my achy breaky heart, I just don't think he'd understand. And if you tell my heart, my achy breaky heart, he might blow up and kill his man.
There's nothing on Some Gave All nearly as instantly catchy as Achy Breaky Heart. If Billy Ray Cyrus, a polite, hip-wiggling, Kentucky-born singer-songwriter, isn't the very definition of a one-hit wonder, I don't know what is. For a while there, I thought Achy Breaky Heart was pretty charming, a nice little country ditty whose chorus you can't get out of your head. But by now, I resent it being in my head. I've heard it so many times on pop radio, on country, on top 40, even on college radio, that I've come to hate its achy, breaky little heart. It's not really Billy Ray Cyrus's fault. He seems like a talented musician and a perfectly nice guy, except for that tiny ponytail that looks more like a possum's tail. But mega success hasn't just overexposed his music, it's turned it into a song that's constantly tracking you down and smothering you with its unwanted affection. I haven't felt this beleaguered by a piece of music since Foreigner's I Wanna Know What Love Is. Here, I'd like to share a bit more of my pain with you.
Don't tell my heart, my achy breaky heart, I just don't think he'd understand. And if you tell my heart, my achy breaky heart, he might blow up and kill his man. Don't tell my heart, my achy breaky heart, I just don't think he'd understand.
And if you tell my heart, my achy, breaky heart, he mightn't blow up and kill this man.
The only way to drive Achy Breaky Heart out of our heads is to replace it with a better song, and I've found one. Iris Dement is an Arkansas-born singer who's just put out an album on Philo Records called Infamous Angel. Dement will be lucky if she's ever infamous, let alone well-known. Her country music is a little too folky, a little too gospel-y to make it on commercial country stations. Then, too, some of her compositions are as treacly as Billy Ray Cyrus's. But if I had to hear another song as frequently as I've been subjected to Achy Breaky Heart, it would be the first tune on Infamous Angel, a simple, wonderful piece of work called Let the Mystery Be.
Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worrying about where they're gonna go when the whole thing's done. But no one knows for certain, and so it's all the same to me. I'll just let the mystery be. Some say once gone, you're gone forever, and some say you're gonna come back. Some say you rest in the arms of the Savior if in sinful ways you lack. Some say that they're coming back in a garden, bunch of carrots and little sweet peas. I think I'll just let the mystery be.
It's safe to say that Iris Dement isn't going to top any record chart other than the one you or I carry around in our heads, the one that gives us the urge to hear a song over and over. And because Let the Mystery Be really does possess some mystery, and because it really does let it be, lets her mystery hang in the air as her voice fades away with each chorus, we have a song that's far more heartbreaking than anything Billy Ray Cyrus can muster.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Everybody is worried about where they're gonna go when the whole thing's done. But no one knows for certain, and so it's all the same to me. I think I'll just let the mystery be. I think I'll just let the mystery be.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the Supreme Court decision on abortion with Catherine Colbert, who argued against the Pennsylvania law in the Supreme Court. Also, Alice Walker discusses her new novel with us. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.